Hi there. We are Charles and Eileen, the French-Swedish artist and husband and wife duo behind this show.
Since going full-time for our art, we've had to deal with endless questions such as, when will you get a real job? And instead of letting it break us down, we've used the energy as motivation to share the real story behind artistry and creative entrepreneurship. Because we are absolutely certain that we're not alone in having to deal with similar judgments, and we want more of you to feel confident in the realness of your creativity.
Along with personal episodes of our artistic journey as a fiber artist, we also share interviews with other professionals in their creative field.
So if you are a full-time artist or creator, or you just feel that you have an increasing urge to turn your passion into your living, then this show is for you. And if you're a frequent listener, then don't forget to hit that subscribe button and give us a review. In this episode, we have the chance of speaking with Pola, who is a Russian fiber artist and who shares her journey and experience of becoming an artist and how to develop your style and, well, most importantly, find your style. You have to experiment, try different techniques, because how can you know what you actually like and feels true to you if you haven't tried different things? I'm also sharing some behind the scenes of how I'm doing my video posts on Instagram. It's pretty heavy secret. So make sure to tune in on this episode if this sounds interesting to you. We're going to start out with Pola sharing her story of how she became Pola Lab.
Actually, it's a funny story because I come up with this name, I guess like 10 years ago or something, before I started doing any embroidery or anything. But I was always doing some handcrafts. I was doing felting, I was making textile dolls, I was making crocheting and sewing bags, just crazy amount of things. And I was also studying as a chemical engineer, so I was mixing a lot of things, and I thought that it's definitely a laboratory of different techniques. That's why it was a Pola Lab.
I think it makes perfect sense. Your crafting and embroidery, it actually traces back a long time for you.
Embroidery, I would say not for that long, because maybe I tried like 5 years ago to work with laces. I started with making this 3D flowers with laces, and for me it was just amazing how much volume you can make with such a flat things. It's just crazy. And of course I was making some accessories with that, and then I tried I went to a workshop and I tried just thread painting kind of, or something, just made a little bird, and I thought that this is really cool, and I should also work more with threads, because, I don't know, they're more like, you can paint with them and make something very nice. Then I also thought that it's a little bit too flat for me. I was also making so much of volume in my works before that I thought that just making plain threads is not enough for me. That then I start exploring and experimenting, and that's how I come up with my own style of combining ribbons and these threads.
I love how you explain this whole like gradual experimentation, because I think that's a lot what the modern hand embroidery is a lot about, to just try to figure out this new space with an old medium in a way and see how we can combine it. What was the reaction around you when you started to want to do embroidery?
Well, of course, when I started doing basic things, like, nobody noticed anything. But as soon as I come up with my own style and my own this birds, it was like, wow. And people start like actually loving it and asking for me to make more of these kind of things. And it's just amazing. And of course, like, I understand that if I would not experiment with materials, I would not come up with this interesting way. It's just great to experiment. It brings a lot of new feeling to your work, and you can just invent something. It's just cool.
You mentioned just before we came, or I hit record, essentially, you just told us how you have one corner where you do your embroidery and it's a bit messy with your threads, though I think it looks kind of organized because you've got your color gradients just perfectly in this ring. I wish I had it like that. Anyway, and in the other room, you have your drawing and stuff. Do you always try to make a sketch before, or how is that experimentation process going?
I always make the sketch before. I like to have everything organized, but still my husband thinks that this is just a mess. This is still a mess. Well, I'm making this kind of patterns from which I'm making the birds, and I also always keep them in this kind of photo album. It's very convenient. So I can always take a pattern which I already made before and replicate it in the same way, kind of, and I like it this way. I am not ashamed of repeating my works, kind of. I think that maybe I made already like 50 black hands, and it's okay, it's great, because I think it's a great product and people love it, and why not? If it's developed nice piece with like great design, why not to do more of it?
Absolutely. And do you feel then that if you do the same pattern or style in like this black hands, for example, do you feel that you still improve?
Yes. I actually wanted to make also an illustration for this year, because there was a fourth big change in the development of this hen, because the first one had metal legs and a plain smooth place where was the eye. Then at some point I added natural feathers. Then next step of development was that I made a 3D volume eye. I added glass bead and made kind of a lot of stitches around to make it kind of pop out more. And this year I started making textile legs, and it was a huge step for me, because like it's quite a process to find a way to make it the way you want it, like. Because no one teaches you to make, like, I don't know, tiny chicken legs.
That could be an idea, bro. Online course of tiny chicken legs. How did you find your first client? Like, so just to say to people, Paula, you are from Russia, right?
Yeah.
Where exactly in Russia?
I was born in St. Petersburg, and I come there quite often. But now I live in a small town called Chudova. Because my husband works here, and we just live next to the mill where he works. Actually, the move to this place made a huge step for my development as an artist, because that's the time when I started working full time, and I was able to spend time to explore and make new things, actually do stuff, because I was participating exhibitions like small craft fairs even before I was doing embroidery. But now when I made this huge step and moved here, it's just the time when I could make something new and explore myself.
So you started to find people locally with your embroidery, such as clients?
No, I don't have any local clients. Like from Chudova, no one, because in Russia, the difference between small towns and big cities like St. Petersburg and Moscow is huge. It's just insane how big the difference is. It's not about only the income, but about the lifestyle, the mindset of people, about how they look like, what they are wearing, what they want from their life. It's very big difference. So most of my clients are from St. Petersburg and Moscow, and some big cities from Russia generally, and of course internationally, after I start selling on Etsy and people start finding me on Instagram.
That's cool though. So do you go to Moscow or St. Petersburg for craft fairs still now, or did you stop that since Instagram?
Well, last year I tried to kind of craft, not craft fairs, they're kind of expos, I would say. because there are many artists, many firms there. And one of them was jewelry exhibition in Moscow in February, and that was a total wreck, I would say, because most of the stuff there was more like antique jewelry and very shiny metal things. So all the people were dragged to the spots where everything is sparkling. And I felt quite lonely there with my threads and my birds. But the other one, which I visited this December, like last December in Moscow, which was related with dolls. And there was a lot of teddy bear artists and different artists of everyone is doing their own things. I met a lot of people who were interested in the jewelry pieces I'm making.
Curious to hear, because then internet and Instagram must have played a huge role in you being able to fully develop and work as a full-time artist since you don't have local clients as much. Or in the beginning, were you traveling for these fairs more frequently?
I think the internet is the main resource for selling your product and meeting the people who want your things. Of course, exhibitions are interesting, but in the beginning, it is mostly just to show yourself that you exist. So, generally, first exhibitions, you don't get much clients because people are just not sure who you are and what is this, what is that. You will talk a lot, try to show yourself your pieces, but it is not necessarily a success. It's always a hard step for everybody to participate in these exhibitions because it's also quite expensive because you need to pay for this stand, you need to have a place to stay, you need to eat something these days and travel. Not easy. So I would say it's definitely much more easier in internet and even the same amount of money you can spend on advertisement and maybe get even more clients.
Did you spend on advertisements for Instagram, for example?
Yes, of course. And at some point, I had a budget kind of how much I could spend because I was in the beginning paying for the posts in the societies, which were, for example, like, I don't know, Art We Inspire, like this account. They have a huge following, and you just pay them, I don't know, 30 euro or something, and they make one post, and maybe from there you can get like 100 people who come to your page or something. And of course it depends what you do exactly, how cool is the picture, and how much feeling is in it, so people will be interested to go and see what you are doing. Because if the picture is bad and it's not interesting, it will be a waste of money anyway. So I was doing that. I was also doing gifts to some bloggers who were making pictures with my things and posting them on their pages, and from that also came quite some amount of people.
I've heard a lot about Instagram influencer you were talking about that we pay and we have a post. Since the algorithm changed, I think the game for them changed a bit. Isn't it better to pay directly Instagram for make like your own targeted ad nowadays than paying them? Do you have any idea about this?
I was not using this kind of advertisement in a while, so I think that that is the main reason why, because I do not trust it anymore. Because in the beginning it was understandable that, because all of their pictures have so many likes, so many comments, that they definitely pop up in the feeds very often. But now, of course, Instagram is changing and the game is also changing. So you need to be very sure that if you choose to pay for this kind of advertisement, that it will worth it actually. So now, if you know how to pay for advertisement in Instagram, of course it's nice to do that, but of course there is a lot of things to learn to do it yourself. It's not an easy thing. Just press a button, pay some euros, and think that you will be super famous.
What are some concrete strategies that you've used, or have you used other strategies than paying these influencers to grow your page and increase your audience?
I also made marathons. Like, this is a free embroidery lessons. So people would be subscribing and following me, and everybody was doing the same thing kind of at the same time, and everybody was checking with a common hashtag the process of everybody. So that is a huge boost, but of course you need to offer people a very interesting topic to work on, because if your marathon is too easy, people will decide not to kind of waste their time on that. So it needs to be still very has a lot of resources and interesting information, and then it will be huge, because the marathon which I made this summer, there were 3,500 participants there.
Wow. That's amazing. Congratulations. I had no idea. That's amazing. This is such an interesting concept with these marathons. So it's so essentially a way to engage your audience during a set period of time and thereby make them super fans, essentially. That they the idea is that they come back and they have a positive experience, right?
Yeah. But of course, most of this following who are willing to learn, they also tend to not be my customers as a jewelry product, because they want to learn. This is a little bit different area of people. And of course, you need to be kind of everywhere, and you need to know which kind of, what is your creative path. Do you want to be like a small factory producing many pieces and just selling them? Do you want to be teaching and mainly doing that, and at some point doing your pieces? Or do you want to be artist and just not care about anything?
I really appreciate that you bring this up, because I'm not sure we've talked about that as much on the podcast before, because it's actually a question that we talk about quite a bit, to just try to recognize the market and also your audience, the sort of different markets that are covered within your audience, because it's the same for us. It's two different markets, the potential collectors and potential like people who want to learn and make their own. And it's sometimes very difficult to balance and to sort of juggle. Is that even a word? To, you know, okay, guys, you can't see me, but I'm like dancing around here.
Interested in your feed, kind of. You need to be in touch with both groups. And of course, when you have more groups, the more people you try to please, the harder it is.
Do you have any, like, I don't know, tools or ways that you try to think of this for your sake?
I am still working on that. And of course, I'm also trying to change my path a little bit, because since last year I decided that I would like to be more like an artist. So I started making bigger pieces and making a collection of things, because I don't know, for me it seemed like an idea that artists are making collections. I don't know why, but I think that making just one wall art is not enough. You need to be like periods or something. So my idea of finishing this first collection in last year was not very successful because of exhibition. I couldn't finish the final piece. So it made me very stressed this January, because I want to finish that one and start already a new collection. So this is kind of the direction which I would like to go. But of course, and those pieces in my Instagram, they are not very popular if we check the likes, for example, because people generally like my common, like the birds, like which I'm usually making. And of course, for me, it's sad because I try to show more of me, show other things. And when there is no much of feedback on that, it feels kind of bad. But I also understand that it's just a third group of people which needs to like these things, because people who like jewelry, they will tend to not be interested in art, maybe, because it's just the way it is.
I think I'm a little bit in the same boat as you, in the sense when we try to make bigger pieces, and Charles and I were also in the transition where we would like to make bigger exhibitions and create a sort of collection or series or whatever we can call that, but just closer studies. It's a little bit what Charles now has been transitioning into with doing the figurative and these close-up study of the eye that he posted recently. And I also want to try to expand in my style as well. But like you say, these more, what could you call it? Mainstream sounds like, feels like it has a negative connotation to it, but maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But just when it's more accessible, it seems to work. And at least that's what I've seen on my page when I've just been consistent and with the open, accessible thing. People like it.
I'm actually interested of what you said, because I've did a drastic change on my Instagram feed lately, because I went from architectural to anatomy. So that was pretty big. And the reaction at the beginning was not so great. And I realized that pushing on the subject that I wanted to change, to believe in it, people really shifted. And now they accept it after a lot of posts. So I really think that if you want to suggest to someone something new, it needs to get like a bit of it, you know, and it takes actually time for them, I think.
Yeah, I've noticed your blue period. And I think it's really cool. It's really cool that you just do what you feel like is right and what is inside of you. And I also started making person wall art, like there is a woman there. It's not a bird, but I'm still using kind of my technique, combine it with the threads, and it's just very interesting, and there is nothing like that in internet, so I still will continue do that, and I believe that someday people will notice it and people will love it.
What's your experience with self-doubt and wondering whether what you do is good enough?
I think it's a constant struggle of an artist, that we always will be thinking that if it's a good one or if it's a bad one, and we will have our favorites and our not like less favorites. And sometimes the opinion which we have will not be the same with the people around us. Like, there might be things which people love and you still think that it's a lousy thing. I don't know, somehow, because I don't know, to sometimes, for example, if we make pictures for Instagram, they need to be eye-catching. They need to be nice. They need to be pretty. And sometimes it even does not matter what is on them. It feels like that you just need to follow some rules to make the picture nice, and then this is the way to get this amount of likes. And if you just post not so eye-catching picture of a more precious thing which you think it is, it may not have so many likes and feedback, because I don't know, it just doesn't follow these common rules of cool pictures.
Do you ever feel limited in having to post a certain style of picture?
Yes, I limited myself to have a white account. So I at some point was posting only pictures with white background, and they were generally close-ups, because you don't always have a white like sceneries in the city or at your home, so it's very hard to add up their different style of pictures, but then I understood that maybe it is not so important and that I should show myself sometimes, and for that it cannot be just white because I'm not white and like the place around me cannot be white all the time. And I don't know, generally you try to post not home pictures, but like that you're in some nice place and you cannot go to only one color places.
Maybe it's easier now in the wintertime when it's like snowy outside, but on the other hand, I'm not sure to do embroidery outside in the cold will like even work.
No, it won't. And you will be like so huge in this clothes and won't be so nice. I don't know.
How did you deal with that internally in just trying to accept that it's okay to change?
I guess I just decided myself that it's okay if I do not post picture every day. It's okay if the picture is not in one color, that I just should post what I like. Maybe it's nice to keep an eye on the feed that it kind of matches somehow between each other, but still, the main thing is to show what you feel like and to show the moment. Because for example, if you're in some nice place and you made pictures of some process there, it's cool to post it right away. Because like in a week, you will have a different process and you will evolve the same piece. But you cannot post those pictures because, I don't know, those pictures are quite old already. They're not showing the real-time feed. And I just realized that my Instagram is more like a blog. It is not a neat website where everything have to be perfect. So it's okay if there is some chaos. It's okay.
It sounds like a very healthy, actually, outlook on it. And I wonder how did you feel when you made this change? I can imagine it must have been some release of pressure.
Yes, it is. It still is, I would say, because now I also know that it's cool to post videos. But for example, I do not have my Charles who can help me with the videos. And I don't know. I'm working alone in my studio all day, and when my husband comes back home, it's already dark, and I don't know, you cannot shoot so nice videos.
You want to know my secret for videos? You know, all of the videos, it's actually, I'm doing them myself, most of them. I'm putting my camera in my scarf. I'm not even joking. I don't know where my phone is. I'll show you with Charles' phone. Now, nobody can see this, but at least you can. So I put it in my scarf like this, and then I just hold my breath to make sure to not move too much, and I do like this, and then I do some stitches, and that's it. That's how professional it is.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I decided to not help Helen for videos because she knows what she wants, but I don't really know what she wants. So that's where we get like a little problem here. So I'm like, Helen, you will do it yourself. And then I remember she was trying to find any way to do like a video. And one day I see her like this. So I'm showing like she's blocking herself with a scarf and she's embroidering and not breathing, not saying anything. And I was like, are you okay? Saying nothing. And then, yeah, I was just doing my close-up video.
So that's the story behind close-up videos. You don't need any like fancy setup. It's okay to use a scarf and just not breathe.
It depends how long is the video.
Well, the good thing is that the close-up videos on Instagram, or like not even if it's close-up, just videos on Instagram, you know, you have a maximum of 1 minute. So, you know, you're already limited there. And then I started posting videos. I started this scarf technique almost from the, like quite early on, because I just... I don't know. I never really had a strategy from the beginning. I just could never imagine it would grow so fast as it has. So I was just posting the process, and it just happened sort of. And then I just thought that, what do I like to see in other people's feed? And I thought, I love to see the process and I love to see videos of how people do things, because then I can see that and I can think of, okay, how could I do that and implement that and use that in my experimentation? Such as, for example, when you went to this first workshop, you learned the tools, you saw how they did it, and then you start experimenting in your style. So that's what I did, and I started to post these videos. And what I noticed is that it actually doesn't matter so much if you have a 20-second video or a 1-minute video. It sort of works relatively the same, and I haven't noticed a big difference with the algorithm changes either. So 20 seconds, I think everybody can keep their breath for 20 seconds. So guys, try it out.
Yeah, I will try. Well, I will find a scarf.
You know, some other things that I did in the beginning too was to like put my phone on the table and then just sit on the floor and try to center the embroidery under, you know, so that you have like the height of the table. And so that was a bit more messy, I think. But of course, if you do have a real tripod, that's definitely like advised. Sometimes it's just about getting creative. You have mostly pictures in your feed. Is it a goal to do more videos, or you feel that pictures is quite enough?
Well, I think for me it's a goal, because I would like to add more videos, but it's a hard goal because I'm not satisfied with the result, because the ones which I make, I don't like them so much. And I guess I would like to have kind of more professional looking videos, and it's a hard task.
Do you put a lot of pressure on yourself that it has to look perfect for you to post?
Well, I think I do, because maybe with pictures not so much, because when you learn kind of your tricks, it's already easy to replicate them and make something alike. But with videos, I did not find those yet. So it's still a lot of pressure to make a video for me.
How do you deal with this? Like, because I put a ton of pressure on myself all the time. And that's where I'm like so happy to have Charles to sometimes just like, Ellen, chill down. Like, just relax. But you are working from home alone. So how is that work, like just dealing with it alone?
Well, if I am home alone, it still does not mean that I'm working alone, because I have my colleagues, and we generally also just put Skype on and we have kind of our own workspace and we can talk and work together, even though we are hundreds of miles away.
So it's like, where did you find these colleagues? That's awesome.
In Instagram. You just talk with people and see that if they're nice, if you feel comfortable speaking with them, if you feel comfortable to be silent with them, that's just amazing. You can be even, I don't know, 6 hours in Skype with somebody and just eating, doing your work, showing the process, thinking about something, and giving some, I don't know, chit-chat talks, and they keep you going. You see that somebody else is working next to you and you cannot give up.
Yes, like this is like the best advice I've ever heard. Now again, I have my live Skype here all the time, but I don't know if people heard that in the microphone, but Charles just proposed that me and him can Skype each other to be Skype buddies. Yeah, well, it's funny. We have this house now since about 1.5 weeks, and it's massive, but we still end up sitting like on the same side of the couch in the same room. So I'm not sure we need we need a Skype. But I think this is an amazing advice for everybody working from home alone, and who just like, for example, Danny Ives at Be Good Natured, she uses, or like she listens to a lot of podcasts, and she said in that way she feels as if she's not alone, because she listens to conversations and people are there, and then maybe she texts her husband about her thoughts about it and she feels that she's engaging. Emily Ferris, that we also interviewed recently, she also talked about Instagram colleagues, but I don't think that it was in terms of Skype. It was more in terms of just chatting.
Well, Danny and Emily, if you listen to this podcast, you can Skype with us and we will onboard her all together.
Yeah, and Paula and everyone, let's just do like a Skype date.
We can make a group call.
I've never done a Skype group call because I was actually thinking that that could be a cool thing for the podcast if we would be able to manage that with a group call, but maybe it will just get super messy. Maybe. Yeah, we went to the gym for the second time this morning, so we're feeling like we're super fit. Or not.
You're lucky you have a gym.
And we have a gym in this little village. But how, so you say that when you moved there, just, we actually didn't talk so much about the time frame from when you started. So when did you actually start to work for full time?
November, December 2015 when I moved. And by the springtime of 16, I created my new birds, my product, my personal amazing thing which I do. And I come up with idea actually when I was asleep. Since that time, I'm just working alone because it's not nice to find a work here, I would say, in the city, because it just doesn't feel that you can make a career here. And of course it was a big step for me, and some months were maybe demoralizing because you are not making any money and you are just kind of in the flow trying to find your way. And of course, even when you start, it's still a not so stable income as, for example, the work which I had before I moved. Like, I was a corporate worker in a huge startup with a lot of people, young people, with parties, with, I don't know, like fruits in the office and some getaway parties and cool stuff happening every day. And then I just quit and move to a village, kind of course it's called city, but I would still count it as a village comparing to a big city. And you just end up being alone and trying to make up something of yourself. And it's a huge step, and many people did not understand how could I quit a job with stable income and just to nowhere, kind of, this is step to nowhere.
Like, kudos to you. I think it's, we all need more courage to just go for what we want to do, because it's so easy to just I can imagine that you must have received a lot of social pressure that you're crazy to do this. And what would you respond to them in that situation?
Of course, I always wanted to do something with my hands, and I always felt that this is the opportunity when I can actually do something. And of course, I also understood the people who were asking me those questions, because maybe they just don't have the thing which they like. It's actually very hard to find the thing which you like to do. And when you don't know what it is, of course, you will never be brave enough to just give up on everything to do it, because you just don't know what to do. So it's very easy to explain them that it's okay to do what you love. And maybe the goal is not to have stable income and be doing like same thing over and over for somebody, but just to make something of your own.
It's exactly the same arguments that we have, actually, that, I mean, of course, some months it's just super stressful and you're like, how are we going to make it? And, oh my God, we have to pay the rent and we have to pay this and that. But at the end of the day, to be able to spend every single day where you are in charge of your time and what you put out in the world, it's, I think it's worth more than money and stability. In a way. Now, for you, two and a half years down the road, or like do you feel that it was the right decision for you? Or do you ever just wonder, wait, what did I put myself into?
Of course, I think it was a great decision in the end, because of course I'm always doing accounting things and like checking what I was doing, how much I was making then, how much I'm making now. Like, now I could say that I am already stable and having like maybe not the income which I had, but already quite average salary of a working person in Russia. So it's totally okay if I'm making this money, and like, why do I need to do something what I don't like if I can do this make this money doing what I love?
So you came from chemical engineer, and then you were studying chemical engineering, you said, and then you were working in this corporate job, but you were still doing some jewelry and thing, and then explore the embroidery. Because I'm just trying to think, because you said it's like, actually it's a super valid point that it's so difficult to actually know what you want to do, and I think that is the struggle for a huge deal of people, actually, that they don't really have a thing that they absolutely love. Or maybe you ask yourself, do I love this enough to risk everything just to do this every day? So I'm just trying to dig, how did you know what was that thing that you were going to do?
Well, I grew up in a surrounding of creativity because my mom was working as a seamstress at home, and then she started working in the theater. She was making costumes for plays and different things, and it was always a nice atmosphere, a lot of fabrics, a lot of things to experiment with. So even when I was a kid, I was like making dresses for Barbies and like doing things with my hands. And for me, it was more interesting to make a dress for Barbie than just play with it. So I guess from that, it was like first steps to understand that my way is creating something. And I tried so many things. Like I was doing wet felting, dry felting, knitting, crocheting, like so many different craft areas. And now I know that each of these decisions to try that made an influence on how I'm working with the things now, because I can combine all this knowledge to make something new, what nobody can do, because not everybody knows all this variety of things. But of course, when you don't know what do you like, you still need to try. You need to try different things before you stumble on it and see that this is the thing.
There's this saying that a woman I look up to a lot said to me once, move your ass and your mind will follow. Instead of just sitting on the couch and trying to just think what you want to do or think what you will do or enjoy or anything, just move your ass and just get doing. I think it's a little bit the same with studies in a way, because it's so difficult to know what should I study, what should I, you know. Well, if you don't try it, try to start with reading a book about it or something like that, I'm thinking. But do you still do, like, for example, knitting sweaters or something like that? Like, do you do other kinds of crafting on the side of what you show on your feed or not?
I make shirts for my husband. That's kind of the best present I can give to him, and I think he already has like 7 shirts which I made. And since a while ago, when we travel, I try to find a nice piece of fabric and then to make a shirt from that fabric. So it will be also a memory from this trip.
So you have one from Berlin now, because you were there just over New Year's.
Well, but all the shops were closed because it's a holiday season and I didn't find anything. But I brought some nice cotton fabric from Malaysia. We visited this October. We went to Singapore and Kuala Lumpur, and in Kuala Lumpur I went to this old market and I found a very nice hand-painted cotton, and I'm planning to make a shirt from that.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. I'm just about to get started on knitting a sweater for Charles, because that's what sometimes I can miss, to just do other things like crocheting or knitting or something like that, because now the feed is so focused on embroidery. So that's why I was just curious to know if you are also doing something else sometimes.
Well, of course, we also need to have a hobby because we have our work. We can do the hobby in the free time and we can have creative hobby.
Good point. I didn't think about it that way. That's great. So knitting is my hobby and embroidery is my work.
Yeah, you still have hard time to think this way. Because yesterday she was like, oh, I feel like I did nothing. I'm like, but you did embroidery all day. Oh, yeah. But it doesn't feel like work. I'm like, but this is your work. So you really have to think each needle, each stitch, it's a work.
I suppose that's the blessing when you love what you do. It doesn't feel, even if like we technically work all the time, but when you love something you do, it doesn't feel so heavy. But so we talked a little bit about, everything now, but I'm just curious to know, you are selling your own pieces, but you're also doing some patterns and tutorials and workshops and different things. And I know that you did online course. And would you like to tell us the experience of that?
Material for learning is always hard because you want that everybody will understand it. So you put a lot of effort to show all angles of the process. And I made tutorials, PDF tutorials from this huge marathon, which I made this summer. And it's like, I don't know, 33 pages with pictures and everything very detailed. And I also translated it to English, by the way, but I don't know, I do not have so many English speaking following, which was interested in that. So most of my lessons are for Russian speaking people, and they like my PDFs, but I also made a video course, and that course I made with a big school, which has also workshops with watercolor painters, like acrylic painters, and they had all the equipment and the studio, so they just invited me over, and I showed all the process, and they were making close-up videos and very detailed things, and all the editing was on them, and all those workshops end up on their platform, and we had a split share of this income, kind of, because I did the work and they did the work. But at some point I noticed that workshop got stolen, actually, because in Russia it's quite a big problem lately that many workshops get stolen by societies of people who like to kind of split the cost of the workshop among like 100 people instead of one person. Of course, for them it's very nice to pay very little for the information they get and just share it everywhere. But it is quite demoralizing and hard for the artist who actually put so much of effort and develop the technique, develop the course itself, and film it, edit it, and put it online, and also give the feedback with people who are doing the tasks and submitting their work. From that time, I did not make any more workshops like that, the online workshop, because I don't know, it's quite a hard hit.
Yeah, and I understand. I know that it's a sensitive topic to talk about, so that's why I was a bit hesitant asking first, or at least I could ask 45 minutes into the show. No, but it's actually, you reached out to me about this when we've just recently released one of our courses in Russia together with Nitka Moskow, who did all the translation and everything. And we were a little bit hesitant to do it at first. And it's the same, I think it's the same with even our English courses. And whenever you put anything online, you always risk having it stolen from you. And I am pretty sure, I can almost like guarantee that our patterns are most likely being distributed and sold elsewhere, not by us. And with the online courses, I don't know yet. We haven't encountered it. And to be honest, on our side, we try to sort of close our eyes on it a little bit, because at some point, I don't know what you think, but it's if you let it win and you stop creating things just because you're scared of getting it stolen, then in a way you lose the joy of actually creating. And I want to believe that people who really appreciate you as an artist, they will try to look up who is the artist and try to get it from you. The people that buy it cheaply, they wouldn't be your client anyway.
Of course it does, of course. And for example, when we go to the shop and creative area and find some creative book, and we read it and we find that it's a nice one, we can give it to our colleague and the colleague will read this book. And we don't think that this is something bad, kind of, because we just shared what kind of we own, our book with lessons for creative things. And of course, some of those people who are split sharing the price of the course, they have this kind of explanation of this event. And I also understand that they do not have feedback from me, for example, because of course the original course, it has a good quality videos and they can submit each like their process, and I will give my feedback that they should change this, they should change that. And of course, all of the people who had split share, they would not have this opportunity. So it does not change the idea that teaching online is a bad thing. Of course, it's also cool because it gives opportunity for people who live far away to learn something new. And it's very nice.
Would you consider to make an online course in, let's say, English, for example, to reach the international market or just if you think that there is the difference between the international market, let's say, or Russian market for this?
It's very hard to say, but I know for sure that in Russia, people are obsessed with workshops. Like, there's so big competition, there is so many artists, there are so many just people who start making something and they like in 2 months already they will make a workshop from some like, so the quality of the workshop is also a question sometimes, because you would rather go to the artist you know and you like the works than to just a average workshop, no name kind of. For example, I visited Finland. It's a country of my husband and I know a lot of people from there. I noticed that no one is doing crafts at home, like no one is interested. And people who are doing something with their hands, they are very respectful, very, very respectful to the people from whom they learn. So every workshop they attend, they have so much of positive energy in that that it's just a very big difference. But of course, there are so less of them that it's hard to understand. And I also do not have many requests for me to teach in English. That's why I was not considering of making English version workshops, because like, I don't know, when I made PDF, and no one is interested, then I'm like, maybe it's not so interesting. Then I will just continue doing my things and creating. Maybe they just like the product better.
I think one thing that is cool with something like embroidery and handcraft in general is that it works all over the world. So the fact that you are able to sit in your studio and have mostly Russia as your market and still make a reasonable income and just make it happen is incredible, I think. And it's actually something that we should really push on a bit more, that we don't have to always go for the international space or let's say America, or for us, America is our greatest market and it's our biggest clients. They're mostly from America. And it's funny, sometimes we have friends over. Now on New Year's, we had a friend and the boyfriend, he was like, oh, I thought you were selling to Sweden. I think in the past 2 years, we had one pattern sold in Sweden. So maybe the Swedish market, maybe we just haven't managed to, like, we had a lot of people coming to workshops though. That's worked out, but online, I don't know. I think it's also different. Like you're telling me here about the culture of workshops in Russia, for example. And I think this culture or presence is also very different in different countries, where in some countries, I think maybe for our online courses, at least, I feel that, for example, in America, they're used to that kind of learning and it feels natural to them. Whereas in let's say we've had some French and some Swedish actually asking us, what is an online course? Because it's a new concept, maybe they haven't learned handcraft in that way, because I don't know, like I learned it at home with my mom, who's a seamstress too, and we just, you do it at home, but you don't really display it outside. And I'm imagining in Finland, it might be a bit similar. You do it maybe, but you don't really do it outside as much. I don't know, maybe I'm just rambling now, but it's just that my point is just that you can make a business or do your passion in your own market, so to say. You don't have to just think too far too soon. What's your thoughts?
Well, maybe I should try. But for example, for this year, I thought that I should try to make actually live workshops, because so far I didn't have any of those. Because now I live in a small town, and for me to gather all the things and go somewhere sometimes is a big deal. Even though I go quite often to St. Petersburg, but I don't know. Most of people who are going to workshops, they live in Moscow, and going to Moscow is already a big deal. But of course, I also do the live streams in Instagram and show some small process and talk a little bit about my goals, how my week went, and this kind of things. And I have quite a big following of Russian embroidery beginners, I would say, like who just went started their path, and for them it's always interesting, like I don't know, how to calculate the price of the piece, and how to, I don't know, to where to put your things, how to market your things, and this kind of questions, which kind of you cannot make a workshop of that, but you can still talk about it when you're doing something. And like, I don't know, I made myself a challenge this December when I made embroidered a small hoop with a logo, which I could use with making pictures in my Instagram. And I also offered people to participate that, and there were like over 300 people who said like, yeah, that's a nice idea, I also want a logo. So I was just embroidering and talking about things, and they saw live how it's developing, how my logo is developing. And of course, I just expected that maybe some of them were working on their logo during this time.
I think it's a brilliant idea, because it's a bit like doing the Skype session with your friends, just as you're live streaming it so that everybody can take part. It's absolutely brilliant. I definitely think this is a space that can be developed and thought about further. But first, I want to say, like, just I realize I've already taken 1 hour of your time, and thank you so much for coming online. Before letting you go, I just have one last question. If you were to start over tomorrow, like let's say that you have no Instagram account, you've got like nothing, and you have to start tomorrow, what would you do?
I would be embroidering every day and just working a lot, working hard. And this is the only way which you can develop your skills and get better. And when you get better, you can already make something amazing and something great. And this is the only path for people who are working with their hands, I think.
Continuous practice. Now I'm about to cheat, because I'm going to ask you one more thing. And that means... it was not one question, but whatever. And where do you see Polar Lab going in the next year? Because I think it's a bit hard to say, like sometimes Charles likes to ask in 5 years or in 10 years, and that's kind of far away. 1 year, what are some big milestones you have?
In 1 year, I would be definitely giving some live workshops where I meet the people. Maybe I would have a couple more courses with, for example, some super tiny miniature embroidery and maybe large scale embroideries with paints, because I also like that technique a lot. And of course, I don't know, maybe travel somewhere and make a workshop there also. That would be amazing.
I definitely hope and see that happening for you. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you for everyone listening. Where can people find you?
Well, you can always put Pola Lab in Instagram or on Etsy or just polalab.com and everything Pola Lab. This is me.
Perfect. We're going to put that in the show notes so that everybody can just head over and just check out your beautiful things and maybe say hello.